Randy, could you tell me a little bit about how the Brecker Brothers band formed?
Well, I'll make a long story short. I had been writing some music. I had 9 charts, and the original idea came about to bring Michael Brecker, my brother, who I had been playing with for many years, together with Dave Sanborn, who had moved to New York from Woodstock, and I had known Dave since we were 15. We went to band camp together. I thought that would be a great horn section. And we had the nucleus of a band we had previously had called Dreams, in Will Lee on bass, Don Grolnick on keyboards. And we brought in Chris Parker on drums and Steve Kahn on guitar. And we were rehearsing music every week. And that I had planned to actually do a solo record, but I got a call from a gentleman named Steve Becker, who had just signed a production deal with Clive Davis, who was starting a new label called Arista. And Steve said, "You know, I heard about this music you've been writing. If you call the band the Brecker Brothers, I'll sign you to this deal. It's a great opportunity to work with Clive Davis." At first I said, "No, it's supposed to be Randy Brecker record. I wrote all the music," but it was such a nice opportunity, even though Dave Sanborn looked like a long-lost cousin standing out front with us. That's how the band was born.
Okay. Now you also recorded and performed with Billy Cobham. The recording Shabazz was a lot of fun to listen to, and it still is, even now.
Yeah, well, Billy was great. You know, we've been playing together since 1968. We played together for a year and a half with Horace Silver, then for another couple years with Dreams. Then he left Dreams to join Mahavishnu, and shortly after, when that band broke up, he formed his own band and hired me and Mike back with Glenn Furris on trombone. And we made a bunch of records pretty quickly. Shabazz was one of them, and still stands up. And I still love playing with Billy. He's created the style single-handedly, and I was there to watch it develop.
Now, you've worked with who's who in jazz and pop music over the decades. You did one session with Jimi Hendrix for a tune that later became known as South Saturn Delta. Do you remember that session or?
Well, those sessions were, I hate to say it, posthumous, or however you say, pronounce it. He had died, and Alan Douglas, his longtime producer, and I think he was his manager, had a bunch of unfinished Hendrix tapes. So he recorded whatever he had, and added, I think on some added drummers, on some others added horn sections. So I remember the sessions, but I don't know if I ever heard the finished product.
You also worked with Clark Terry's Big Bad Band. Could you tell me about that experience working with Clark Terry?
Well, he was the guy who just started my career in New York. I had met Clark in 1965 at the Notre Dame Jazz Festival. He was a judge. I won a trumpet prize that he handed me, and a year later I moved to New York. And about a month after I'd been in town, I guess through the grapevine, he gave me a call and asked me to join his big band. I think it was before it was even called the Big Bad Band. It was just Clark Terry Big Band. This is in probably 19, early 1960, late 1967, early 1968. And he was just a mentor to me and thousands of others. What a great human being is. And amazing trumpet player, but the greatness of his humanity almost transcends his greatness as a musician.
Another person who I dare say had those same qualities as Horace Silver. You did a number of records with him, including that Healing Feeling. That was a great record.
Yeah, well, Horace was very spiritually oriented, and I kind of tried to model my life as a band leader, since he, like he would, have treated Sidemen, and just the idea of writing my own music really came through watching him go through life and writing tunes about this occurrence or that occurrence or that place or this place or that lady or that person. So he was a big influence, and his music was a healing force, as he put it, and that was a great record, and I was happy to know him and be a part of his life.
And when you visit Omaha next weekend, and visit the UNO campus also. You'll be teaching aspiring music students. So what's the most important lesson that you try to teach aspiring music students?
Well, the most important thing, I think, off the top of my head, as simplistic as it sounds, you have to really love what you do. You have to love your instrument and love music and love to play. And if it's your calling, I suggest you go and try and do it. If you feel it's the least unsure about it, I suggest you keep music in your life, but maybe do something else professionally. The most important thing, I think, is really to have music in your life and understand the basics and love it, you know, because it's just life can be tough and it's always there at the push of a button. And I also stress the importance of daily practice and the fact that you can be the most talented person in the world, but you have to work on your music. And I always use Stevie Wonder as an example. I played with Stevie for about a year in 1973, and nobody worked harder on his stuff than he did. It was a 24-hour process.
Who are the sidemen on your tour right now?
Well, I just got back from Norway, where I was playing with some Norwegian guys. But for this particular gig out there, I'm using the guys from Des Moines, Iowa, who were highly recommended by Dick Oates. Tanner Smith on piano, Chris Smith on drums, Graydon Peterson on bass, all of whom I had heard of before. But this is going to be the first time, honestly, that we played together. I sent them the music, and they're all excellent musicians, so I think the sparks will fly. I really enjoy playing with new guys and not playing with the same guys all the time. So this was a good time to do it since budgets were limited. And these guys came highly recommended, so I'm really looking forward to playing with them. Things will happen that won't happen if you play together a lot.
Exactly. Who is your favorite trumpeter? Who do you draw your inspiration from?
Well, I don't know if I have one. That'd be a tough question. You know, I have probably 50. and the usual cast of characters, but one guy that I really like, who's not familiar to American audiences, is the German trumpet player Till Brönner, who B-R-O-N-N-E-R, who's a big star in Germany and Europe. He's a wonderful, just a great trumpet player, flugelhornist, performer, and maybe even more importantly, composer, arranger. So I heartily recommend that people look him up on YouTube, and you can sign some great gigs. He really is excellent, one of my favorite young players. But the usual guys, Freddie, Lee Morgan, you know, Dizzy, Miles, Kenny Dorham, Thad Jones. I've listened to them all. Woody Shaw, who was a compatriot of mine. We were the same age. And I do listen a lot, so I couldn't really just name one guy, but Till just saw on YouTube the other night, and I thought I'd mention him. And the other guys that I'm listening to, the trumpet players and Snarky Puppy, are killing me. That whole band is great.
You using wah-wah pedal back in the 1970s on some of the Brecker Brothers recordings. Do you see that ever? Do you see that coming back in jazz?
Well, it depends on the band. I just brought up Snarky Puppy, and they use effects occasionally on their solos. It depends on the music, but effects on horns seem to work pretty well. It was kind of an accident when I tried it. We had John Abercrombie in Dreams as our jazz rock guitarist, and he felt he was more rock sounding if he used a wah-wah pedal, and there was a rehearsal that he didn't show up for. He was busy, but he had the wah-wah pedal sitting there in our rehearsal studio right in front of his amp, and Mike and I were using an effect called a condor, which was one of the first effects you could use that was made by Hammond. It was specifically for horns, not that great effects, just different kind of gurgly sounds. And I plugged my quarter-inch jack to the wah-wah pedal, and man, it sounded great. So we started using it right away. This was pre-Miles. He used to come and hear us in Dreams, and he started using it, and it sounds great on trumpet. And I remember, cut to a few years later, and I had never met Miles, And it's a kind of a cool story. Mike and I owned a club called 7th Avenue South by then. And Miles happened to be standing next to me. It was crowded that night, and I held out my hand, introduced myself, told him I was a big fan, and he didn't flinch. He didn't say anything back. I just kind of walked away, say, I just made a fool of myself. And a couple hours later, I was nursing my injuries at the bar, and I heard a little wisp of air on my left ear, and I heard, "I love my Wawa, you love your Wawa." And he split. That's all he said to me.
Yeah, that's Miles. As cryptic and as ever, he was known for that. One of your great tunes, of course, is Some Skunk Funk. That's a superb number. I play that many, many times.
Well, thank you. We play it. I don't think we're going to play, well, maybe we'll play it at this gig. We're going to do more jazz-influenced stuff in Omaha, but not all jazz. There's some kind of fusion-y stuff. And I've played some Skunk Funk for so many years. I love it, but I'm starting to get a little tired of playing it. It's funny, there's more hits on YouTube. I just went there a couple of days ago, and there are 37,000 hits of Skunk Funk. So there's 37,000 different versions or people playing it on YouTube. Serbian tap dancers, Japanese all-girl orchestras. So that tune took on a life of its own. It's almost like a rite of passage for young musicians to have to learn it and play it. And then when people see me, they always want to play it. So I have to sometimes say, yeah, maybe not tonight.
Exactly. You've owned a number of clubs, if I understand correctly, and with the challenges for young artists to find a place to play in today's climate, what would you tell them if they're looking for gigs and they're having problems and all that?
Well, we only owned really one club for 10 years, 7th Avenue South. That was more than enough. But it's difficult now. There are less places to play. But what I tell people, it seems jazz has become more localized, and I think that's a good thing. Like, you know, I'll go be out in Omaha. I'm sure there's great players out there. There's a great scene. There's obviously a nice performing arts center. There's probably a bunch of great bands out there. That didn't exist years ago. So even though there aren't that many places to play in small towns, there seem to be good jazz societies. There are great musicians in all over the world now. And you just have to work at it. You know, try and write your own music, teach, and play. If you have those three components, that kind of makes for a more secure lifestyle. You can't just depend on playing in jazz clubs, or just playing jazz for that matter.